This is a special broadcast of the meeting of the Institute for Historical Review, March 6th, 2010. Brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. This is the speech by Mark Weber.
As I mentioned earlier, ladies and gentlemen, earlier this week was an event that we had long been anticipating, the release of Ernst Zindel from prison. As I mentioned, for 7 years, this courageous man was held behind bars in the United States and Canada and Germany for his peaceful expression of nonconformist views. As I've said many times, this makes him the most prominent prisoner of conscience in the Western world today. Now, Ernst is still, well, when he came out, one of the men, young men who congratulated them, who was there to greet him, said to Ernst, "Well, I'm glad you're free." And Ernst gently rebuked him, as was mentioned earlier today, that he's not free. Ernst Zindel, of course, is still gagged by bizarre laws that forbid free expression of opinion about World War II, the Third Reich, and the Holocaust. Now, his ordeal and his suffering have very special meaning for me because of a relationship that goes back more than 20 years. At the Great Holocaust Trial in 1988 in Toronto, I testified in his behalf as a court-recognized expert witness on Germany's wartime policy and Final Solution policy. In September 1994 and again in May 2000, I was pleased to welcome him as an IHR conference speaker. And during the 7 years that he was behind bars, I spoke out in countless interviews about his ordeal and the significance of his ordeal. And I helped to organize street demonstrations to protest his imprisonment, and I arranged for public talks by other free speech activists who spoke about the Zindel case, including Ingrid Rimland, Paul Fromm, and others. A good measure of the deceit and double standard of the American mainstream media, by the way, a term, mainstream media, that is used increasingly by younger people, MSM, is to compare the way the media has treated the fate of Ernst Zindel and to make a comparison the way it has portrayed Nelson Mandela. They point up very well this kind of double standard in our society. Right now, in movie theaters across the United States and around the world, there's a motion picture showing called Invictus. It stars Matt Damon and Morgan Freeman, who plays Nelson Mandela in this film. And, of course, the film portrays Nelson Mandela, the South African black leader, in a very flattering, very sympathetic, very laudatory way. Now, for years, Nelson Mandela was held in prison in South Africa when the country was run by its white population. And he became president in 1994 when power came into the hands of the African National Congress, the major black political party in the country. And yet, the portrayal of Nelson Mandela normally leaves out one essential fact. Amnesty International, the well-known human rights organization, during all the years that Nelson Mandela was behind bars in prison, refused to take his case because he was not a political prisoner. He had, in fact, committed numerous violent crimes and had had a fair trial and a reasonable sentence. Nelson Mandela was head of the terrorist wing of the African National Congress and the South African Communist Party. In his trial, he pleaded guilty to 156 acts of public violence, including mobilizing terrorist bombing campaigns, which planted bombs in public places, including the Johannesburg railway station. Many innocent people, including women and children, were killed by Nelson Mandela's terrorists. South African President P.W. Botha, on a number of occasions, offered Nelson Mandela freedom from prison if he would only renounce terrorist violence. And this is something that Nelson Mandela, in all the years he was in prison, refused to do. Indeed, for years, Nelson Mandela was on the U.S. government's own watch list of terrorists. And he wasn't formally removed from this list until 2008, when he was removed by special law signed by President Bush. Now, in contrast, Ernst Zundel was held for 7 years in prison, including 2 years in solitary confinement, solely for the peaceful expression of his views. And yet, in our society, all the articles that appear normally in the American media and the German media, of course, portray him always in this very unsympathetic, very critical way. No U.S. politician, no U.S. government official ever expresses any sympathy for the fate of Ernst Zundel and the suffering and the ordeal that he underwent. And yet in our society, over and over, including in major motion pictures, Nelson Mandela is portrayed in this very, very favorable way. Nelson Mandela is a terrorist. Ernst Zundel is a prisoner of conscience. In our society, Nelson Mandela is praised. Ernst Zundel is criticized. Well, why is this? I have made this point over and over in media, that one thing that ties together the people who speak at IHR meetings, whether they're talking about the Palestine issue, the Middle East situation, the fate of ethnic Germans in World War II, in the aftermath of World War II, or the fate of Ernst Zundel, we live in a society that insists upon what can be called a Jewish-centered, a Judeo-centric view of history and the present. Everything is filtered through that. So events in history and current events are filtered through that perspective. And that's what's wrong in our society. It's a reflection of power. Because how history is viewed in any society is determined by those who hold power in that society. They say that the winners write the history books. But more importantly, it's people who hold power in any society that determine how we view history. And how we view history is how we view ourselves and our place in the world, our place in society. And the fate of Ernst Zundel is a tragic one. It's a terrible one. In a just society, his ordeal and his suffering would receive strong support from the American media, from American political leaders, who are very quick to speak out about what they regard as violations of human rights or free speech if they happen in Iran or in Myanmar, Burma, or in some other country. But when they happen in Germany, and when they happen to a man who has no record whatsoever of support for violence, they are silent, because he's on the wrong side of this prism, this Judeo-centric prism of history. One of the points that I wanted to talk about today is something that is very close to my heart, and that is this issue of criticism that we might receive. Now, many people, some people here are active politically. Other people are, of course, even by being at a meeting like this, take a certain step. It's considered brave because the IHR comes under criticism and attack. Well, we're under criticism and attack and have been for many years, not merely by a really terrorist group called the Jewish Defense League, which actually firebombed the IHR's offices in 1984, but by organizations like the Anti-Defamation League and the Southern Poverty Law Center. By the way, if there's any two organizations which are more inaccurately titled, it's those two organizations. The Anti-Defamation League engages in defamation on an almost continual basis. And the Southern Poverty Law Center is anything but in poverty. It's one of the wealthiest organizations. In fact, it's so wealthy, they can continue to operate for years just on the interest of all the money they've acquired and put into accounts over the years. But in any case, the IHR and many other groups have been criticized by these groups and by other groups, including this another inaptly named organization, the so-called One People's Project. It's really a neo-Marxist, neo-communist organization, a very small group, but they are critical as well. But for me, and I think we should all look at it this way, criticism by such organizations shouldn't be regarded as something that should alarm us. It's a badge of honor. Criticism by organizations, by the Anti-Defamation League, the SPLC, and so forth, are really confirmations of our effectiveness, that we're doing the right thing. If we're not being criticized by such organizations, we're either ineffective or we're irrelevant. And those people who, in fact, there are several people here in this room who have come under pretty intense criticism from these organizations. Now, that's one form of criticism. And instead of being worried about it, we should remember that we're in a struggle, and in a struggle we make enemies. And we make enemies, above all, of bigoted, sectarian groups who regard organizations like the IHR as harmful to their particular sectarian interests. And that's as it should be. That's understandable. And instead of being fearful of that, we should be proud of it. It comes with the territory. It's absolutely the way we should expect it, especially at a time when the charge of hater, anti-Semite, and so forth is thrown out by organizations like the Anti-Defamation League so loosely, so wildly, that they've lost much of their effectiveness. Now, the American media, the mainstream media, is still in accord with all of this, is still acting and treats groups like the Anti-Defamation League as paragons of insight and justice and so forth. But that should be completely rejected. Now, there's another form of criticism that I wanted to talk about as well. The IHR has had, over the years, speakers representing a wide variety of political views, a wide variety of ethnic background, racial background, religious background, and so forth. The IHR, because we have a speaker, doesn't necessarily mean that we endorse this or that particular speaker. In fact, it would be impossible, because many of the speakers we've had over the years hold very conflicting views of one kind or another. But we try very much to welcome speakers, especially if they're substantive and intelligent and logical, well-founded speakers who speak out in a way and provide information that is contrary to this stultifying main conformist view that is so much a part of our society. Now, the criticism that many people often get, and this is just a kind of a sideline, is it's a very disturbing thing that another form of criticism that we should just pay no attention to, and in fact it also comes with the territory, is criticism from people who are supposedly on our side. Many of these critics are armchair warriors who are online critics who are quick to criticize just about everybody for this reason or that reason. They're very quick to suggest that this person or that person might be an agent or secretly tied to the CIA or the ADL. A charge, of course, that is impossible to disprove. How do you disprove you're a CIA agent? Well, I'm not an agent. That doesn't seem to do much good. Or many of these critics are quick to complain because this or that group or this or that individual is no good because he doesn't say anything about the 9/11 conspiracy. Or maybe he's not sufficiently speaking about what Jews are doing. Or he's not speaking about this. Or he's not really talking about the big enemy, the Federal Reserve. Or maybe the Rothschilds or some other thing. This kind of criticism is corrosive, it's cancerous, and it's usually, as I say, carried out by people who write anonymously on the internet, who won't put their name to anything, and that's another form of criticism that should just be ignored. And I say this on the basis of years of experience, and there are others here in this audience today who can also confirm that that's another form of criticism that's not even worth responding to, not even worth replying to. Now, in spite of all of this, I look at this meeting here today and what's been happening in the last year as an expression of the times we live in and what a time of opportunity this really is. More than ever before in our history, the American people sense that something is very wrong in our country. Polls show that most Americans think the U.S. is headed in the wrong direction. And surveys also show that for the first time ever in American history, Americans now believe that life for their children will be less prosperous and less secure than it has been for them. Now, this anxiety is much more than worry about the economy that's going on right now. We're having a recession. We've had recessions many times in American history. But never before during times of recession or even depression did people think that life 20 years from now for their children, or 30 years, was going to be worse than it was for them. Now, although the U.S. is still a country of great resources, wealth, and military power, Americans have never been so socially divided, confused about themselves as a nation, and worried about the future. They are concerned about rising social economic inequality, an erosion of national identity and purpose, increasing social polarization, and growing contempt for the U.S. around the world. An abysmal failure of political and cultural educational leadership in our country has brought an unprecedented breakdown of trust. Americans are understandably fed up with political leaders who deceive and mislead them. They feel betrayed by politicians who support costly and destructive wars that do not serve authentic American interests, who refuse to halt the massive influx of illegal immigrants, who approve immense government spending on programs we cannot afford, thereby imposing an irresponsible burden of debt on our children. And in accord with our leaders' illusory principles and unrealistic policies, the U.S. is rapidly becoming an ever more confused and disorderly third world country. Whether Republican or Democrat, our political leaders lack candor, an informed view of history and the world, and a reality-based vision of the future. With each passing year, it is ever more obvious that the leaders of both major political parties pander to the powerful Jewish Zionist lobby, and in doing so, betray the principles of our nation's founders, as well as the interests of our people. Now, while politicians of both major political parties loudly promised change during the last presidential campaign, it's amazing. Both the Democrats and the Republicans are promising change. The fact is, the blunt reality is that no establishment politician, no matter how eloquent or seemingly sincere, will alter the country's basic direction. And that's because for more than half a century, America's political, cultural, and intellectual life has been systematically skewed to benefit alien interests. In our motion pictures and television, I gave one example, in classrooms and textbooks and in government, powerful interests have imposed a false and harmful version of the past, distorting the historical record for self-serving reasons. And as a result of all of this, our nation can neither understand itself nor direct its sight clearly toward the future. Unless and until the interests that have gripped our nation are clearly identified and discredited, there will be no change in basic policies or direction. And that's why I believe the work that we are doing is encountering the forces of historical deceit, bigotry, and cultural distortion is so vitally important. Now, in that regard, I'm very, very encouraged by what's been happening during the past year with the IHR. Never before in the history of the IHR have we had such a level of networking with people locally. Never before such a level of volunteer help. Never before such a rootedness with actual people on a day-by-day, week-by-week basis. And a lot of the credit of that goes to several people here this evening, and this meeting is one expression of that. Now, earlier in this meeting, we're talking about the AMRAN conference and the problem of harassment and threats that forced cancellations by four hotels of the American Renaissance Conference. I wanted to say that something similar has happened with the IHR. We've held many meetings and conferences over the years here in Orange County and in other places, but especially here in Orange County, without any particular problems. There was big problems in 1989 because of the Jewish Defense League, and that was a very, very special case. But by and large, we've been able to hold meetings without any special problems. In recent years, we've often held meetings at the Ayers Hotel in Costa Mesa. One of the reasons that this was encouraging, or it was a source of some sort of confidence to have them at the Ayers Hotel, was that this is the same hotel that has hosted meetings by John and Ken, who, if you live in Southern California, you certainly must know. They go right to the edge, you might say, not over the edge, but they go right to the edge in their criticism of mainstream politicians and the media. And they've encouraged a heck of a lot of hatred and animosity from Mexican-American groups in particular and from liberal groups in general. Now, We've held a number of meetings at the Ayres Hotel, but in 2008, we held a meeting there with David Irving, and at that time, the local newspaper, weekly paper called the OC Weekly, it's owned by the parent company, also publishes the Village Voice in New York, it's a Jewish-owned company, had an article written by the same person who runs the Ask a Mexican column, pointing out that the Ayres Hotel had sponsored the notorious IHR, sponsored meetings by the notorious IHR. Well, nothing particular happened at that time, but then in this past year, in July, we held a meeting again with David Irving, and once again the OC Weekly went to work. Now, nothing particularly happened. However, the hotel received threats, complaints, and so forth from the usual suspects at the Ayres Hotel for sponsoring or allowing us to hold a meeting there. We've always had very good relations with the Ayres Hotel. Paid our bills. Everything's been always smooth with them. Never any problem. But at that time, a local policeman from the local police came, checked on the thing because they had received word that there might be trouble. And I was told because of the, I was thinking of having a larger meeting, making this better known, I checked with the Ayres Hotel and I was told, unfortunately, a couple of weeks ago, that we would not be allowed to hold a meeting again at the Ayres Hotel. They said because, well, the police had come and talked to people. Well, I don't want to question anybody what they say, but I think it's a little bit more than that. I think it also has to do with the fact that the OC Weekly and the other so-called and various anti-fascist groups had highlighted the relationship between this hotel chain and the IHR. But in any case, we were disinvited. Now, that's why it's very fortunate that we have a place that we can meet like this, in which, although we are not able to hold as meeting with as many people as we would at a hotel, and perhaps not in as nice and congenial circumstances, we are able to hold meetings here because we have a place. And in that regard, the IHR is one of the very few organizations anywhere of our kind in the United States that actually has a headquarters, a building, a something where we can hold a meeting like this. And for that reason, as I've said on many occasions, we are very pleased not only, of course, to hold our own meetings here, if need be, but also to welcome and allow our facilities to be used by other groups which we may have nothing else in common, but if they share anywhere near, they show some sort of support for what we're doing, we're glad to make our facilities available for them as well. And now that's a difficult thing because it also means that at some point our own headquarters could be vulnerable. So we have to be constantly mindful of that. But in any case, I wanted to make maximum use of the fact that we actually have a headquarters. Now, there are many people who are concerned about the sacrifices they make because they support this group or that group, especially if they're going to be criticized. And I know that that's an important factor. I've suffered and I've had to deal with this in my own family life. Many of us have, for example. But one person who's been a very, very good friend of the IHR for many years was going to be going to the American Renaissance Conference, and he took his son, and they went instead to the Antietam and Gettysburg battlefields. Now, I've been to Gettysburg myself, been there twice. I've been to some other Civil War battlefields. It's well worth doing it for no other reason than to realize what real sacrifice entails, what real sacrifice involves, because as difficult as things might be for any of us, it's nothing, nothing compared to the sacrifices that people have made on both sides in the American Civil War or in real conflicts. Nothing. In the American, one thing that was so striking to me at the battlefield at Gettysburg, they showed what an officer's bed looked like. Well, it's a tiny little rickety thing. That's for officers. Enlisted men, the vast majority of people in the Union Army and certainly in the Confederate Army, they slept on the ground. Well, if you've lived in the East Coast for very long, in Virginia or Maryland or North Carolina, it is very uncomfortable in the summertime, and in places like Virginia and Maryland, Pennsylvania, very, very uncomfortable in the winter. In the winter, it snows. It's below freezing. In the summer, it's hot and humid. There are mosquitoes. That's why many people in the Civil War, a huge percentage of people died, not from bullet wounds, but from disease. That's sacrifice. Day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, to be sleeping out in the open like that, to be having terrible food, to be marching that way, to be cut off from your loved ones. And the sacrifices made by the families of these people, their wives at home, their children at home, having to run their farms, their shops, or whatever, without their menfolk. Very, very hard. In the Confederacy, when the Confederate, right after Fort Sumter and the Civil War began, many of the most idealistic young men in the South rallied to the Confederate flag and volunteered for the Confederates, Confederate forces. Shortly after that, everybody expected the war would be over very quickly. Shortly after that, the Confederate Congress passed a law stipulating, requiring that every man who was in the Confederate Army had to stay in it until the end of the war. 5 more years of fighting it went on. Imagine that. I mean, that's sacrifice. And of course, many of the men never came back. More Americans died in the Civil War than in World War I, World War II, the Vietnam War, and the Korean War combined. That's sacrifice. And so when I think about the sacrifices that many of us make for groups like the IHR, the various political parties, that's very little compared to the sacrifices that so many men made just in the American Civil War. And of course, there's many other examples in history about tremendous sacrifices that were made. Again, this has to be kept in perspective. Now, in all of this, I just want to say that the meeting here, and this is our great challenge, this is a time of tremendous change in America. I think people sense that something is very wrong. It's above all wrong because the country is different. It's a different country than it was 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. California is not the same place it was. I've made this point many times. For 40 years, Eastern Europe was under Soviet domination. From 1945 up until, 89, 90 or whatever, 87 and so forth. But after the Soviet hegemony and rule ended, Hungary went back to being Hungary. Poland went back to being Poland. Czechoslovakia broke apart and became the Czech Republic and Slovakia. Romania went back to being Romania. But during that period of time, California has changed more than if it had been occupied by the Soviet Union. It's been changed demographically, culturally, in ways that our ancestors, or even our grandparents, just would have been astonished by. There was a recent article in one British newspaper talking about those people who lived in Britain. This is in Britain during World War II. How the Britain they see today is not the Britain they fought for and certainly not the Britain they wanted. That's not the country they wanted. Now, I've made the point over and over and over that the principles upon which America and Western Europe have been operating since 1945 are essentially wrong. And all of the problems we're seeing today are inevitable consequences of pursuing policies and allowing things to happen on the basis of these principles which are wrong. And this is part of our challenge, to put these things in a historical context, in a larger historical context. And the IHR tries to do that week after week, month after month. And what we have to do is turn the rage and unhappiness and confusion of people and direct it and help them to understand why this is all happening. People know that something's wrong, but who do they blame? The number one talk show host in America is Rush Limbaugh. To hear him tell it, everything was just great until the Democrats took over. To hear Rush Limbaugh tell it, every morning he tells the people, it's those Democrats and Barack Obama that screwed up everything. Has he forgotten that it's the Bush administration that everything began falling apart in? But these people persist in the belief that if they only had another Ronald Reagan out to save America, everything would be fine. The Democrats and liberals in general, they have an equally false sense of why we got into this situation, why things are bad, and they refuse to acknowledge the most basic and obvious reasons why we're in this trouble. Anyway, the IHR has an enormous task, and I think the great task is to try to provide intellectual leadership at a time that it's absolutely crucial, because our current intellectual leaders in America have failed miserably, and they continue to fail, because what they say week after week, month after month, is either a distortion or a lie about what's really going on in our country and why things are going on the way they are. So again, I want to just conclude by once again thanking you being here today, and many of you who have been here have been wonderful in giving support in very specific ways, with volunteer help, with money and so forth, moral support and so forth, over the last year, and I'm very, very pleased to greet you here again today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks for listening. Visit the Institute for Historical Review at ihr.org and visit VOR at reasonradionetwork.com.